This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're with Jeffrey Lamar Coleman, who is a professor at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and who edited this book called Words of Protest, Words of Freedom, which is the most significant compendium of voices about the civil rights poetry. And we'll hear about that, but first we're going to hear Jeffrey in his own voice with his own poems.
Thanks, Grace. I'll start with two poems. And the first poem is, I walked to the beach to clear my head, but, and this poem is written in memory of Trayvon Martin. I walked to the beach to clear my head, but there's no need to unpack my camera to capture the day's ascension, for the sun will not rise from darkened waters. There is no need to take out my journal to scribble as fast as I can, because I can no longer forget the onslaught of thoughts. This morning, no blue herons have appeared, no mallards, but a million seagulls riot in midair with their haunting squawks of Trayvon, 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 until they drop one by one into sunless, mangled waters. The second poem, which is related and unfortunately in some ways, is titled Chokehold, NYPD. And this poem is written in memory of Eric Garner. Chokehold, NYPD. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I plead over and over after being slung to the sidewalk, pinned like a hog to be slaughtered. Strangled by forearms I cannot see. I plead over and over. I can't breathe. My face slammed and pressed to concrete. Four cops crushing my body as my six kids and wife fade in and out of me, like air rising and dying in my lungs. They remind me I am human. More than just another disposable black man, unarmed and exterminated on an American street. No, they tell me, I am more than that. So for them, I plead. I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, over and over, until finally I no longer can.
That is the voice of Jeffrey Lamar Coleman, who, as Bruce Weigel says, say it simply and clearly and make it beautiful. Make the ugly beautiful. What does art do for us, Jeffrey? You have done such amazing work. How does art help us? Does it help us?
I believe art does help us, Grace. It can help in multiple ways, depending on the receiver, depending on the audience. But for my purposes, art has always served at least two functions. And one, as a creator of art, as a writer myself, is I wouldn't necessarily say it's therapy per se, but it is definitely therapeutic. It helps with the thinking process and trying to grapple with everything, and helps to contextualize and make meaning out of things that sometimes seem senseless, acts of senselessness.
That makes sense to me.
Yes.
Yes. Didn't Frost say clarity out of chaos?
Yes, exactly.
Right. And I think even more over time, all these voices seem to come together as one voice. And it is really kind of the sound of transition. It is of every poem you write, Jeffrey, every book you edit, eventually comes together to make a different consciousness. If I didn't believe that, I would just fold up in a corner and die.
No, I believe that wholeheartedly myself. There are lots of books out there that can speak to your own sensibilities, even if those aren't books that you yourself have written. But they're related in a kin kind of way. You know, there's a certain similarity with a level of consciousness, awareness, and sensibilities that helps.
And therefore, we must move into this compendium, I believe, is the only one of its kind of its size, which has 150 poems by 100 poets. Tell us some of these icons of American thought, please, that you have put together in this book.
Well, Grace, thank you for that warm introduction of Words of Protest, Words of Freedom, Portrait of the American Civil Rights Movement and Era. This book was long in the fruition process. I mean, from conception to fruition was over 20 years. But in the end, there are a lot of famous poets here, such as Maya Angelou, W.H. Auden, Amiri Baraka, Gwendolyn Brooks, Lucille Clifton, my former colleague, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, Langston Hughes, June Jordan, Philip Levine, Audre Lorde, Huey P. Newton, the Black Panther, even, Sonia Sanchez, Derek Walcott, Alice Walker, and the list goes on and on. But there are also poets in this collection that did not receive a great deal of attention, relatively speaking. And I'm very, I was very proud to give those poets the attention and space that I felt that they deserved.
Well, putting together the joy and the sadness and the triumph and the struggle in one book is something you can be really happy that you've done. So would you give us a sample, perhaps choose one or two of the poets and share that with us?
Yes, I always like to, there are a few poems here that I like to start out with, but one that I keep coming back to as a starter poem is Midway by Naomi Long Maggott. She was, or maybe still is, the poet laureate of Detroit. And her poem Midway from 1959 is always a good one for me to start with, because it contains a great deal of information about the movement and the thought process behind the movement. Midway. I've come this far to freedom, and I won't turn back. I'm climbing to the highway from my old dirt track. I'm coming, and I'm going, and I'm stretching, and I'm growing. And I'll reap what I've been sowing, or my skin's not black. I've prayed and slaved and waited, and I've sung my song. You've bled me and you've starved me, but I've still grown strong. You've lashed me and you've treed me, and you've everything but freed me. But in time, you know you'll need me, and it won't be long. I've seen this daylight breaking high above the bough. I found my destination and I've made my vow. So whether you abhor me or deride me or ignore me, mighty mountains loom before me, and I won't stop now. I think that poem speaks to the level of perseverance that was inherent in the movement, especially if you think about the origins of the movement and how long it actually lasted.
And this is 1959 she wrote this?
Yes, she wrote this in 1959. Yes.
Well, it is a fabulous, powerful poem. And I didn't know her name. Now, there's one more contribution you've made in getting some of these poets known to the public. I have your book, and I did not know her before. So in its simplicity, it says a great deal, does it not? I mean, and it's also very strong.
Yes.
Very strong. Have us another poem, okay?
Yes, I will. And the next poem I like to read is a poem by Michael S. Harper, and it's a poem he wrote about this 1963 church bombing in which the four little girls were murdered by a bomb. And the title of the poem is Here Where Coltrane Is, here as in H-E-R-E. And this poem was published by Harper in...
You had to get all these permissions?
I did. That's one thing that helped up the whole process was...
No kidding.
Was the permission
really?
Process, yes.
Oh, that is a heroic work to get all of that. That must have taken, I bet, a portion of the years, right?
It took a long time. Searching for the funds here and there.
Oh, tell me about
yeah.
it. But I knew Michael Harper very well, so we'd like to hear it.
Okay. And again, this title is Here Where Coltrane Is. Soul and race are private dominions, memories and modal songs, a tenor blossoming, which would paint suffering a clear color, but is not in this Victorian house, without oil and 0 degree weather and a 40-mile-an-hour wind. It is all a well-knit family, a love supreme. Oak leaves pile up on walkway and steps, Catholic as apples, in a special mist of clear white children who love my children. I play Alabama on a warped record player, skipping the scratches on your faces, over the fibrous conical hairs of plastic, under the wooden floors. Dreaming on a train from New York to Philly, you hand out six notes which become an anthem to our memory of you. Oak, birch, maple, apple, cocoa, rubber. For this reason, Martin is dead. For this reason, Malcolm is dead. For this reason, Coltrane is dead. In the eyes of my first son are the browns of these men and their music.
That is poetry. That is poetry. All that listing.
Yes.
And I would like to have everyone know who you are. Jeff Coleman is a professor of English at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and his research includes literature of the American Civil Rights Movement, music of social protest also, and he is the editor of Words of Protest, Words of Freedom, which we're hearing about now, the author of Spirits Distilled Poems, also poetry editor and associate editor of the Journal of Hip Hop Studies. Wow, what is that?
Oh, the Journal of Hip Hop Studies is a journal that I became associated with maybe a dozen or more years ago now, definitely more than a dozen years ago. And it is a journal that wants to, it is the premier journal for scholarship on the genre of hip hop, on hip hop scholarship. And there's...
You are in on a lot of premieres.
Thank you. There's a lot of scholarship out there on hip hop. And when I say that, it's not always commercial hip hop that these scholars are writing about. Not always the music you hear on your radio. There's a lot of underground music. And one thing that's very fascinating about this, and this is something I did not know beforehand, before becoming associated, affiliated with this journal, is that there's a great deal of scholarship that engages the intersections between theology and hip hop. And that's a huge subfield of the field, basically.
I want more of that. More, please. I want to hear more of that. I'm going to get the journal. Really, Jeffrey, you're doing yeoman's work. This is really important stuff you've been doing for the last 20 years. And your own essay, Singing is Swinging,
yes,
The Soul Force of 20th Century Black Protest Music, is forthcoming in a major publication, Black Intellectual Tradition. That's coming out next year. And while we have you as our own, take us back to another poem of yours.
Another poem of mine? Sure, thanks, Grace. I like to read... one of the more recent poems I've written lately, and it's entitled Infinite Folds of Silk. Oh, actually, I will change that to God's Green Earth. God's Green Earth. Was it Christ, Gandhi, King, or Chopra who told me to become more mindful of my existence? More conscious of the very air that enters and exits my body. I often come to this field, to this patch of God's green earth, to think about bodies, to meditate on and release memories of bodies. Again, I have come to make peace with the air that entered a body, this time 16 times. Through the dashboard camera, Laquan can be seen trotting, then suddenly half-turning before falling. Even if I wanted to understand the first pull of the trigger, how am I to reconcile 15 more shots, all of which ravaged a prone, motionless black body? 8 of those bullets entered and exited Laquan McDonald's body. Was it Christ, Gandhi, King, or Chopra who told me to become more mindful of my existence?
Oh, Jeffrey. When you were small, did you look around the world and say, I am going to have to talk about this? When I grow up and I get power, I'm going to describe all this. When did you know that you were given the mantle, really, to say these things?
Well, Grace, interestingly enough, it did happen at a relatively young age. I don't know if I ever thought about it in those terms, about having the mantle to say these things, but in middle school is when a very good friend of mine at the time, this guy named Lance Richardson, who was very much a reader of poetry, and he introduced me to some poets that were outside of the anthologies that we had in school at the time, and we would read and talk about them. And around that same time, of course, I grew up in South Carolina, a place called Gaffney, South Carolina. And there were all these racial incidents happening, and it was just normal for me. I don't even think I thought about it much, but I started just recording some of them in a journal and trying to turn some of them into verse, and one thing led to another, and I just started writing about social issues in middle school, little by little, and that kind of stuck with me. And it wasn't, I don't think, a conscious, deliberate plan or act. It was just something that I think I needed to do, like I said earlier, to make sense of things that often appear nonsensical.
Well, talk about the tiny poem, The American Fantasy.
Oh, The American Fantasy. It's written in the skinny form poetry. I don't know if too many people...
Yes, I do. Okay. Truth Thomas.
Yes, Truth Thomas, yes. Truth is a wonderful friend. The American Fantasy. And the form is 11 lines long, so this is quick. And all except for the first and last lines are one-word lines. The American Fantasy.
So we have 11 lines, yes, with one word on each line?
Except for the first and last, except for line 1 and line 11. And those lines have to be identical, or they have to consist of the exact same words, not necessarily in the same order, but in the exact same words.
I believe Truth actually originated this form.
He did.
Yeah, yes. That's interesting. Yes. And so we would like to hear it.
Okay. The American Fantasy. At least we are not caged, huddled masses yearning. Caged, wretched, tempest-tossed debris. Caged, at least we are not.
Look what 11 lines can do in a small space. And that takes a little bit of discipline, doesn't it? I've tried one of those skinny poems,
yeah,
and I have to say, it is not easy.
No, they're not.
It's like a haiku, because it has to have meaning and discipline and structure. Which brings us to music, actually. And you are a person who chronicles music to our history, I think, in your life and probably in your pastime. I remember you as former editor of the Delaware Review calling for poems on Prince.
Yes.
And you put together a gorgeous issue.
Yes.
And I told you that some people thought Prince was just a very cool entertainer. What was he really?
Oh, Prince was, Prince contained multitudes. He was definitely more than an entertainer. I mean, although entertainer can mean several things, of course, but when I think of entertainer, I think of someone who basically sings and dances, and that's about it. Not that those things should be minimalized or anything, but Prince was a multi-instrumentalist, and always Prince had within him this social consciousness. And that's one of the things that drew me to him early in my life. If you go back and you listen to off the Dirty Mind album, it's like his third or fourth album, there's a song called Uptown. And then there's a song called Party Up. Both of those songs are talking about this area of Minneapolis called Uptown that, that Prince references. But more important than that, it's not instead of just a placeholder, it is within this place called Uptown, a utopian arena for all races and people of different sexual orientations, etc. And this is the mindset that Prince lays out, and is something that he comes back to again and again, sometimes by name, sometimes not. But there is this uptown mentality that takes root early in Prince's musical journey, and he keeps that mentality all the way until shortly before his death, of course, with his protest song Baltimore that he wrote in response to the Freddie Gray death.
He was a beautiful spirit, wasn't he?
Yes, very much a beautiful spirit.
And he saw a world where one light was shining on all of us. That's what he hoped for. That's what we all hope for. It doesn't seem as if we will find Prince on any of our thousands of classic rock stations today. Why is that, Jeff?
Well, we probably won't find Prince on those stations or any, or too many black artists, maybe Jimi Hendrix, but because classic rock is the most glaring and disturbing example of how an entire format ignores or marginalizes the contributions of African-American artists with respect to his playlists, especially. In fact, race and not music appears to be the primary criteria for that format for classic rock. From the on-air personalities, the artist selection, song selection, desired audience and advertisers, it is also the format that is the most indicative of the period in which black music was appropriated and stolen by white artists for the sake of appealing to white audiences. So it's at the root of the problem of the radio industry with respect to race. Black artists created the genre we now call rock and roll, but classic rock, the format that should be playing them and holding them up to, as an example of great music, is in fact ignoring them, oppressing them, and refusing to play them.
So black music matters, right?
Indeed, Grace, black music definitely matters. It's always mattered, and it will continue to matter. And I hope that somehow we can impress that upon the radio industry, especially when it comes to the classic rock format.
Before we hear a final poem, I wanted to ask you something. Jericho Brown said his students come in knowing much more than he did at 19. Can you relate to that?
Oh, definitely. In this generation, Grace, I will tell you, Generation Z, I mean, I don't know them all personally, of course, but my students, they're very much engaged with the world around them. They're very much engaged with their own sense of growth and maturation and development, and especially their mental and physical well-being, much more than my generation was.
Right, and we didn't know we had to save the planet.
No, we did not.
And they do.
Yes,
I know. My grandson was pulling weeds, and he said, "Oh, I can't touch this bee is an endangered species." And I thought, "Oh, I love
wow,
you."
Wow. Okay.
Yes. So let us have a final poem, and let us tell you how much we love you.
Okay, Grace. And on that note, I will end with a love poem, because I think that's something that we need more of, especially in this time. Infinite folds of silk. Then I lived in the time before, when love was a sunrise, and we never spoke of dusk. We never mentioned waves not covering uncovered bodies as we swam towards beneath love, submerged in a realm without end. We never imagined kamikazes of night birds descending into unlit horizons to obliterate dreams of dawn. We were always serenaded instead by seagulls vanishing behind clouds, like ancient rituals of passing through and beyond another world. Their songs, a ribbon of fuchsia, undulating with and against our skin, as if infinite folds of silk binding us beyond ourselves, and we never speak of dusk.
That is the voice of Jeffrey Lamar Coleman. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, with additional support from the Sinipet Fund, Maryland Humanities, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.